When is a cake more than just eggs and flour? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
You know, Barry, it's great to be back with you today, especially considering what we've gone through today to get up and running. Folks, the miracle of modern technology, and sometimes the miracle is that it works at all.
That's right. Usually our show prep prior to recording one of these is maybe 20 minutes or so as we're talking through what we're going to do and making sure we have the right clips to air. But this time around, I don't know if it's just something in the air, Chuck, or if it's just something in our systems. But for some reason, all the technology decided that it wanted to work against us today. But yeah. Thankfully, you know, we prevailed because, Chuck has a lot more savvy about technology than I ever will have. If it was up to me, we wouldn't even be doing these programs because I wouldn't know how to set it up. So I give a lot of kudos to my technical advisor and electronics guru, Mr. Michaelis.
But
sometimes we have to deal with the vicissitudes of what we have to deal with, and so we're having fun here for about an hour trying to get all of the systems to work correctly.
Yeah, well, I'm going to hand the glory to God because ideas pop into my head. There's an old saying that fate favors the prepared mind. Well, it's just a matter of having a jumble of stuff in the, you know, it's like you have a junk drawer and you know you have stuff in there and you know you can make things work if you can just find the right thing. Well, that's a blessing from God. He makes certain people curious about certain things and puts them in positions where they can use what they're curious about to get things done, and that's what we did. We are having trouble. You may have noticed we used to do a lot of interaction with other media on this show, and we haven't been able to do that because Skype is what we use, and Skype has sort of is owned by Microsoft, unfortunately. And Microsoft has done something, and we can't figure out what, to make it impossible to play things like, for instance, the audio portions of videos on YouTube. We used to be able to play those right through the soundboard, and Barry could hear it, and I could hear it. And what has happened is that Skype has rigged it up so that if it's playing onboard my computer, I can hear it, the soundboard can hear it, and Barry cannot hear it. So it's impossible for him to interact with a video that he can't hear or with an audio that he cannot hear. So I was sitting around this morning trying everything I could think of. I'm searching on DuckDuckGo, and by the way, I use DuckDuckGo because they're not nibby, unlike Google, who records everything that you do online, every search that you make, they know about it. I use DuckDuckGo, and they don't care. They don't keep a record of what you've searched. They just go out and search what you look for, and it goes away. That being said, I was searching DuckDuckGo for solutions to this problem, and all of a sudden, I told Barry, I said, hey, give me a second. I have an insight flash. So what I did was I ran up to the house, and I grabbed my tablet, and I have a little thing that splits a stereo output from a regular headphone output jack and puts it into two what they call phono jacks. And I was able to plug that into the soundboard, and it turns out when I play it through that system, Barry can hear it and I can hear it. So voila, we have bypassed Microsoft, and to Microsoft I say, yeah. So...
Now, Chuck, on the downside for our listeners, they still are hearing us.
Yes, unfortunately.
So we apologize in advance for that, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we're really, really sorry. Yeah, but hey, we paid for this airtime. We're using it.
Yeah, well, there's that. But anyhow, so here we are, Chuck. We're into June, and I don't know about your area, but June has now become like the new September here.
Yes.
We went through like the scorching May where temperatures were hovering in the 90s
in spots,
and it was muggy and nasty. And now all of a sudden we hit June, and it was like somebody pulled the bottom. It's like global warming stopped.
It was 52 degrees out this morning. I woke up, and it was freezing in the house, and I'm like, oh, we're down to 65. Yeah, no wonder I feel a little chilly. Yeah.
So. But I'm not complaining about it. I know now that school's out, and, of course, after Memorial Day, the community pools open, and people like getting their pools and stuff up and running. But honestly, it may get warm enough during the day this month in order to maybe enjoy the pool without freezing to death, but I'm not so sure about that. And I'm not complaining about it, Chuck. Just a little, self-complacent note here. We're recording this on Wednesday on the 6th of June. Just yesterday, I celebrated with my wife our 25th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
And 25 years ago on the 5th, this is what the weather was like then. We had, it had been hot in May, and then all of a sudden, like right up the day before and the day of our wedding, God just said, I'm going to cool things down a little bit. And so, it was comfortable. It was pleasant. It was a great day, to be out shooting the photos outside for the wedding or things of that nature. It was just great. And so when I was running around yesterday at the State House testifying on bills and things, I was just kind of looking around like, yeah, this is kind of how it felt 25 years ago. It was like it was kind of a nice little, walk down memory lane just with the weather. So I don't have any complaints about June being a little less scorching than it has been in the past. So, I hope everybody is going to take advantage of this and go outside some more and enjoy the weather. And, when you go, plug in your phone or your headphones or, go over and listen to our podcast while you're out doing your yard work or enjoying the weather or fishing or whatever it might be you're doing in June in this lovely weather. But always take us along with you.
Guess what?
Yeah, slight plug.
The day they're listening to this, in your area anyway, it's supposed to be around 90.
Well, they had said that, but then they've also said that, we're not going to have a day this month. It's going to get over 85. So, six and one, half a dozen of the other to me. I mean, if it does get warm, it is summer. It is going into summer. So there you go. So
bingo. What happens, happens. I mean, that's the bottom line. We'll take what we get. And by the way, I said it was 52. It was lower than that this morning.
I know there was a lot of rain up in central Ohio yesterday. I was, I was up at the State House, and I actually had to go in between, from one block to the other, between different buildings for different things. And so I got a little wet because I didn't think about bringing an umbrella because here it didn't rain.
Yeah.
my neck of the woods, it cooled down, but we didn't have a bunch of rain. So
we had a couple of torrentials. So,
it got a little wet out there.
Kind of segueing it, when it rains, it pours, and it has been pouring lately, and trying to do a Christian based analysis on some of the stuff coming up is keeping us busy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got a lot of things that have been happening, and so we're kind of happy that is, because it's better than us, navel gazing for an hour on the radio when we can just basically go out and say, hey, look at what everybody else is doing.
That's right.
I some of the big things that I think are happening nationally, we had some elections. I guess the California primaries are up, and of course, everybody's, is Dianne Feinstein going to lose a primary? Well, I think the answer is no.
No.
Honestly, I'm not sure about California voters, but, the fact that you elected Jerry Brown as your governor a few years ago doesn't say much.
And you're probably going to elect Gavin Newsom as his replacement.
Gavin Newsom, who is also probably about as big a leftist as Jerry Brown is going to be the next governor. I guess John Cox is the Republican sacrificial lamb who will be running up against Gavin Newsom for governor because, I'm sure there are some people in California thanking God for this. Jerry Brown is termed out. But Gavin Newsom is the former mayor of San Francisco. And basically, he's been the guy that the Democratic Party, both in California and nationally, have been grooming
along with the ex-mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa. But Newsom basically clean clock on a couple of his folks. Basically, John Cox. They have a runoff in California for who goes and battles for governor. It isn't as much like what we do in Ohio, where okay, the Republicans pick a person, the Democrats pick a person, they face each other. They do more of a runoff. And so it just so happens that Gavin Newsom was the big winner, and John Cox is a Republican businessman who, if you remember, Chuck, ran for president. Cox was one of the options for president. And, of course, he obviously didn't make it because we've never had a President Cox.
Was he on the California? He must have been one of those guys that was on the California ballot.
He was on the California ballot. He wasn't on all the national ballots.
Okay.
But he was tracking with about 26% of the vote behind Newsom's 34%, and so he beat Villaraigosa, who was in third place. So because they were so far behind, so Villaraigosa's star in California has diminished quite a bit. If a guy who's a little-known Republican, actually there was enough Republican support to push them over the former mayor of Los Angeles and another, I think, star in the luminary heavens of the Democratic Party. Because you heard about Villaraigosa's name like constantly. It's almost like Kamala Harris.
He's been being groomed for higher office for quite some time. Yeah. In fact,
and my guess is that they'll keep him in the wings to run for Senate or to take somebody's spot in Congress when it needs to be done. But Newsom is the star of the hour. You know, he's the guy who they believe is going to be the great hope. I almost said great white hope because he is Caucasian and Villaraigosa is Hispanic. So they are pushing here for Newsom. And of course, you know what will happen is that some of the other Democrats who voted for Villaraigosa will come and vote behind Newsom. And Cox, well, you know, he may be tapped out at the 26% he got because of the fact that there's really not as many Republicans in California as there are Democrats.
Well, there's a couple things that have to be. First of all, I think Villaraigosa got beat by Kamala Harris for that Senate seat because I think
he ran
for that. Now, California has a very rigged system, more rigged than almost any place.
It could be so rigged that there were reports that almost 119,000 registered voters were left off the rolls in L.A.
Well, it's just beyond that. The way their system works is the Democrats have set up a Democratic Party perpetuation system.
True.
Because they're the majority in the state by far. And it hasn't always been that way, but it has changed since they look the other way while illegals vote there. And let's put it this way. Here's how their system works. When you run in a primary, it's essentially an open, more or less an open. Everybody runs. Yep. And if two Democrats, for instance, are the top two vote getters in a primary, then those are the two that face off at the general.
That's the reason why Newsom and Cox are going to be running for governor.
Exactly. Why there's going to be a Republican candidate for governor because he got the second most votes. Villaraigosa gotten more votes than Cox, it would be Newsom versus Villaraigosa in California with two Democrats. Sure. It would have been a Democrat versus a Democrat.
That's the reason why this interesting report coming out of Los Angeles County is important, I think, because 118,522 registered voters' names were left off the rolls, and so if any of those people showed up to the polls yesterday, they had to give them a provisional ballot. Now, provisional ballots aren't counted in the main count. They're counted separately. And they have to check them to make sure that they weren't, like, cast illegally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Honestly, a lot of people have questions about provisional ballots. We even hit in our primary in Ohio back in May, We had this situation because my oldest son, who this is the second time he's voted because he's, you know, over 18 years old, because he's decided not to get a driver's license yet because he says, there's no place I need to go, Dad, so why do I want to get a driver's license? And I'm okay with that, you know. It's like he's busy working and, you know, building his business and things here and out. He doesn't need to be running around. You know, I'm one of these happy parents that, yeah, my teenagers are not out ripping the roads all the time, and I'm happy about that. But because he didn't have a driver's license or a photo ID of some sort, they were going to make him vote provisionally until we kind of looked at the poll workers and said he voted in November with a straight ballot. Look at your rolls. He's on there. And so they looked, and sure enough, there's his name, there's everything. And, you know, he had his selective service registration.
Oh, yeah, that should do it.
Well, yes,
except it's not a picture.
But it doesn't have a picture. Here's the problem. The poll workers were like, oh, well, it's not a picture idea. I don't think we're going to have to give you a provisional. And my son went over, and they had the rules sitting out there, and he looked down at the rules, and he said, okay, right here, let me read this to you. Forms of ID that suffice include government-issued identifications. I said, "Suck the service card is a government-issued identification card."
Yeah.
And so, and they looked at it, and they were like, and then, so, of course, thankfully, at that point, one of the poll captains or, you know, one of the people from the Board of Elections happened to walk in the room. And, you know, they go around and they check the polling places to make sure that they got everything they need, et cetera. He just happened to come in, and they asked him, and he looked at him, and he said, "Who's got a selective service card?" He goes, "Does it name matter?" He goes, "Then give it to him." He goes, "He doesn't have to vote provisionally." I said, "Thank you. That's what we were trying to tell them."
Yeah.
It's like, he voted in the fall with this same ID. It's like, don't tell me he can't use it. So, you've got this situation in California, though. 118,522. Now, I don't know how big the numbers are really in California in a primary, but I would think that in L.A. County, where Antonio Villaraigosa was the mayor of Los Angeles for years, that could have materially affected his vote count.
You'd think.
Now, who would that benefit if Antonio Villaraigosa's vote count is suppressed, whether intentionally or not, but Gavin Newsom?
Gavin Newsom, of course.
It launched Cox into being able to do a runoff, but then again, a Democrat wants a runoff against a Republican in California because they can win. There's not enough Republicans that they can get the Democrats around them, but a runoff against a fellow Democrat who controls one of the largest population centers in the state in Los Angeles versus San Francisco, wow. I mean, that would have been a tough, tough battle in the fall between Newsom and Villaraigosa, but Newsom doesn't have to worry about that now because he gets very little-known former presidential candidate, you know, just who's actually, I saw, has been on the ballot four times for different offices and hasn't won a thing, John Cox.
Well, it depends on where he's from.
He's only lived in California for a few years.
Well,
so
no.
He's a transplant.
What part of California?
Newsom is from San Francisco.
Yeah, but Cox, what part of California is he from? L.A., Santa Barbara, those areas, he's never going to get elected as a Republican.
Yeah,
never.
Absolutely not.
Northern California, parts of the Central Valley, parts of Western California, parts of some of the suburbs surrounding San Diego, Orange County, he could get elected.
I want to give you the cut quote from Joe Garofoli in the San Francisco Chronicle writing about this today. And he says this, and this is a lovely little paragraph. Cox, the Republican, will face steep odds in a state where only one in every four voters is Republican. Two-thirds of the voters disapprove of Trump, And a Republican hasn't been elected governor since Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2006. And Schwarzenegger was an international movie star with near universal name recognition. More than half of likely voters had no opinion of Cox in a nonpartisan Berkeley IGS survey released last week. Now, what does that mean? They don't know who he is, which means that Newsom will have fun painting him as a carpetbagger and, you know, as a perennial candidate, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is tailor-made in central casting for Gavin Newsom to have a big walk-away election win, become governor of California, and then be the presumptive favorite
for
the Democratic nomination for president in 2020.
Yeah, I don't see that. But
I'm gonna make the pick right here. Newsom will end up being the Democrats' pick.
You think so?
Because the only other real option they're going to have in 2020 is Joe Biden.
Oh no, they're grooming Kamala Harris hard.
Kamala Harris is not going to be able to even make it to the starting gate. The next 2 years in the Senate are probably going to be nightmarish for her, because you know the Republicans understand that. And Mitch McConnell is going to do everything in his power to make her look like an idiot.
It's not going to take much.
No, it's
sorry
really
to
not.
Say. Sorry to
she,
say.
Well, she does it to herself. She's so far out of touch with average voters. You know, that's the Democrats are going to have to start learning. And I hate to say this because, you know, I figure that they, you know, what they don't know doesn't hurt the rest of us. But they're going to have to start learning. You can't do card-carrying progressive leftist extremists, i.e. Bernie Sanders, i.e. Hillary Clinton, i.e. Pocahontas, and expect middle America to all of a sudden decide that you've done this wonderful thing for them, and so they're going to vote for them. I mean, as we saw from the 2016 election, if you took away, what, three precincts in New York City, or maybe it was 13 precincts in New York City, Hillary Clinton doesn't even win the popular vote.
Right. She was elected on the popular vote by extremely lopsided victories in New York and California.
And in California.
Yeah. I've given lectures on the Electoral College and to explain to people. By the way, I'm available for that. To explain to people why that is exactly why the system was designed that way, to keep lopsided votes from taking sway keeping regional politics from dominating national politics. Is exactly right. Why the Electoral College, it's supposed to dampen out lopsided results, which is exactly what it did. One thing that's real important that everybody's kind of not talking about is that this California thing, the way they've got it rigged up so that the top two vote getters face off in the fall and not Republican versus Democrat, this was supposed to be part of this quote-unquote blue wave. What they were going to do was an overwhelming Republicans were supposed to get completely shut out in California. And, you know, I forget how many congressional seats they have. 51?
52 or something
52,
like that.
51, 52. And it was all supposed to be 52 coming in, and it's not getting there. In fact, one of the headlines on Yahoo, which is not exactly a conservative bastion, is California breaks Democrats' hearts. Big blue shutout fails and other takeaways from Tuesday's primaries. Yahoo was touting a story earlier, and I commented on it, and they touted this big story about a Democrat in Missouri who won a state Senate seat that had always been Republican. And she was, you know, they were touting this thing, and I looked at it and I'm like, okay, she beat a rhino who was extremely unpopular because he was a rhino. And she didn't win by all that much. And my answer was, okay, there's one. The blue wave has very rapidly converted to a blue trickle, and very soon I think it's going to become a blue drain, as I said to you. it's quickly looking like a blue drain because of the way Democrats are handling themselves. The fact is, the Democratic Party is in chaos with the vice chairman, who's Keith Ellison, strike one. Although, what's the Tom Perez? Is that the chairman? Keith Ellison is dropping out of
the Democratic Party now.
Yeah, yes. Keith Ellison is dropping out of the House of Representatives to run for Attorney General in Minnesota. He was a late entry into the Attorney General's race. That's what he wants to become an AG because he says that's the place where we can sue Trump into oblivion from the Attorney General seat, and that's what he wants to do. He realizes he's looking at the numbers. He's not saying this, but he's looking at the numbers, and it's becoming clear that the Democrats are not going to sweep the board in the midterms. And in fact, it looks like they're going to underperform from what normally happens in midterms. Because mm-hmm. what normally happens in midterms is that the opposition party makes gains.
Yeah, that's true.
It doesn't look that way. In fact,
no, it doesn't. It actually looks like the Trump effect may still be carrying over.
Yeah, it's beginning to look like the Senate is actually going to go from a majority of 51 to maybe a majority of 54.
Exactly.
And the House, it's beginning to look like it's going to be a wash or a possible pickup for Republicans. So to all our friends out there who have been stating, and I've been saying, keep your powder dry, I've been stating, Trump's going to get crushed in the midterms. Doesn't look that way. And the reasons why, because the Democrats are misplaying their hand. When you've got a special prosecutor that it's becoming more and more and more and more and more obvious is a partisan whose entire purpose is essentially to get Trump, not to get justice, to get Trump. And when you look at Mueller's track record, remember, this is the guy that attempted to railroad some poor schmuck after the anthrax scare. You remember the anthrax scare in the early 2000s, or right after,
after
2000? Well, Mueller was in charge of that, the investigation. And essentially, remember, they were going to railroad this guy into prison, and essentially, he was in charge of that mess. And when the guy got exonerated, I think they essentially destroyed his life. The FBI destroyed his life. And after he got exonerated, I think he committed suicide. I can't swear to that. I think he committed suicide because essentially it didn't matter that he'd been exonerated. The problem was that his life was destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. Because once you are investigated or publicly identified as potentially being someone who sent poison through the mail, you know, anthrax spores through the mail to kill people, even if you didn't do it, people are going to be like, oh yeah, you're that guy.
You're the anthraxer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Mueller was also heavily involved in the Whitey Bulger scandal. In fact, Mueller looked aside while people were convicted of murders that Bulger was responsible for and sent to prison. And essentially, prosecutors who knew full well that these guys hadn't done it and had convicted people who were innocent and sent them to prison were castigated by numerous, not just one judge, several judges who said, this is the worst miscarriage of justice. This is the guy who Trey Gowdy says he trusts. And Nunez has made noises that he trusts Bob Mueller. I'm sorry. This guy should be removed from the office. He has a track record of failing to provide exculpatory evidence. And the Democrats, Rod Rosenstein, who essentially appointed him, who is was the deputy that stepped in when Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, recused himself, has basically promised Senate minority leaders and House minority leaders that he's going to stick with Mueller and protect him. Well, what does that mean? That means, obviously, it doesn't matter really what happens. Mueller's got the job. Now we're getting into silly things like Rudy Giuliani out there popping off the head saying stuff about Trump pardoning himself and all this stuff. I'm like, what is this about?
Yeah, it's interesting you brought all this up, because I'm sitting there thinking, okay, if you remember the anthrax scare thing?
Yeah.
Where was the anthrax sent to?
Oh, gosh.
Now, there was a different number of different places, but there was one in particular. And it was to the offices of the National Enquirer.
The Enquirer, right? That's right.
Office of the National Enquirer, and I think somebody got sick or died from the exposure.
Nope, but that building is still abandoned.
That building is abandoned, so they had to leave the building at the very least. I thought somebody had gotten sick and died, but maybe not. Maybe that was one of the other ones. But, and it's interesting because, you know, you're talking about Mueller and all these attacks on Trump. Well, there's been some attacks on the president. I will say it's an attack on the president.
It's an indirect, yeah.
It's an indirect attack, which basically, you know, I'm not saying that Bob Mueller has done this, but it's kind of like what Bob Mueller did to the poor guy that they claimed, you know, was responsible for the anthrax scare. And it's been done in a fashion that reminds me of the National Enquirer. And what that is that CNN, you know, the Clinton News Network, has decided that the biggest story they can possibly come up with this week is questioning whether or not there's a potential that Donald Trump is beating his wife.
He's beating his wife. This is the...
it's the have you stopped beating your wife yet way of questioning somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Just presuming it's happening, and no matter what they say, they indict themselves to what you're stating, what you're questioning is really a fact. So CNN is playing the National Enquirer, and Donald Trump is the guy who can't win in this. But what they're basically saying is because his lovely bride, Melania, who just about a week and a half ago went through kidney surgery to repair something, to fix something that was wrong with her kidneys, because she's not showing up publicly and out there dancing the jig with him or something, or going to the G7, you know, flying to Europe and, you know, and staying at the embassy or whatever, wherever they stay when they do this kind of stuff, that for some reason it's really just, it's not so much that, it's a signal that perhaps he's domestically abusing her and they're keeping her out of sight until the bruises heal.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got a clip from Tucker Carlson. You and I are both like sitting here, just like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, we're gonna.
They started this in, but this is the level of discourse we have from the mainstream media on all things Trump. And so this whole issue with the blue wave becoming a blue, you know, trickle or a blue going down the drain has got CNN in such a frenzy that they are willing to basically use National Enquirer type tactics. You know, the bold accusatory headlines that really don't have any relationship to fact in order to try to hurt someone a la Robert Mueller that they really don't have any evidence against.
Well, here's the bottom line. CNN has been...
Did you like how I tied all that stuff we've been talking about
today? Yeah. CNN has been doing this now since about February of 2017. In other words, probably January 2017. In other words, right after Donald Trump took the office. Remember the whole, they were the big pushers of the Trump-Russia collusion story. And it, of course, as that has collapsed, they were one of the last ones to realize that the jig was up on the Trump-Russia collusion story. And you'll still hear them talk about it occasionally. But Tucker Carlson kind of takes this apart. We're going to let him talk, and then we'll discuss it after he's done talking about it.
You probably heard that Melania Trump had a kidney operation last month. That kind of thing happens to 48-year-olds, even famous ones. She took a few weeks to recover, stayed off TV, didn't give any speeches, all pretty typical for someone who just got out of the hospital. But over at CNN, they were not buying that story. They are proud journalists at CNN, self-consciously proud. And if there's one thing they know for certain, one thing that was drummed into them at the top-shelf journalism schools they attended, it's that Republican first ladies lie a lot and are evil and for the sake of civilization must be destroyed. So CNN did not buy a word of that, and the network assigned its most dogged journalist to crack the case, the squeaky but persistent Brian Stelter, who hosts some kind of weekend show that no civilian television viewer has ever actually seen. Stelter understood immediately that the whole kidney operation story was just a cover for something darker and more sinister, likely another international scandal emanating from that dark lord Vladimir Putin himself. Stelter hinted as much to his viewers. Watch.
One thing that the president and the White House have been quite quiet about is Melania Trump and her status. The last time we caught a glimpse of her was on May 10th, 24 days, more than 3 weeks. There's been a lot of questions about her surgery, her time at Walter Reed, and now her invisibility.
Okay, Carlson's about to go on and make the ultimate point. What is the ultimate point with this? There are questions about her surgery, right?
Right, that seems to be where he's heading.
Okay, yeah. Listen to Carlson.
Questions about her surgery? Questions about her time at Walter Reed? What questions exactly? Who's asking those questions? Brian Stelter didn't say because he couldn't say. Those are not real questions, and this is not reporting. It's a passive-aggressive attack. CNN's real point was that Melania Trump is a liar, and she's doing something immoral. She must be. Look who she's married to. Stephen Colbert came to the same conclusion. Watch. Yeah,
listen to this.
As of the time we're taping this show right now, the First Lady has not been seen in public for 25 days. Well, I'm not surprised. It took that Shawshank guy years to tunnel out. Melania is supposedly reemerging to attend an event in the White House tonight, but who can be sure? Because the event will be closed to the press. But the White House did release this official photo proving the First Lady was totally there.
Over at Rolling Stone, which apparently still exists, someone called Jamil Smith speculated that Melania Trump was in hiding to conceal signs of physical abuse. At The Atlantic, David Frum agreed and then suggested that the president may have punched Melania and then ordered the Secret Service to cover it up. Keep in mind that once upon a time, David Frum was a serious intellectual, or what passed for one in Washington. Now he's merely a buffoon. And even more buffoonish as of last night, when the actual Melania Trump showed up at the White House for a veterans event, very much alive and unscathed. So much for all those questions Brian Stelter pretended to care about. What's so interesting about all of this is how much journalists hate Melania Trump. Imagine hating Melania Trump. Whatever else she is, Melania Trump is not an overbearing public figure. She's not lecturing you about your weight or trying to control your personal life. She doesn't weigh in on, I don't know, tax rates or global warming. It's unlikely she will run for Senate from New York when this is all over. Nobody thinks she's one of her husband's key political advisors. You may never even have heard Melania Trump's voice. Many people haven't. She doesn't talk much in public. Melania Trump has done absolutely nothing wrong to you or anyone you know or anyone you will ever meet. She married Donald Trump. That is her only sin in the eyes of the press corps, and yet it's enough to disqualify her even from the most basic consideration of decency.
That's the bottom line. She's a sinner because she married Donald Trump. Barry, it must be a really scary place to be a mainstream journalist during this period of siege.
You'd have to think so, that you know, while this serial abuser and Simon Legree character is sitting in Hillary Clinton's chair in the White House, that they're the faithful, loyal opposition making sure that the truth gets out there.
The truth. Okay, when you've got guys like David, now I expect that kind of journalism out of Rolling Stone, which I honestly thought was going bankrupt after that whole business with the phony accusations at University of Virginia. And they got sued by the fraternity involved because it turned out that the story that the girl told was a complete fabrication. And nonetheless, the university president got rid of the fraternity despite the fact that the story was a complete fake. And Rolling Stone stood behind, it's the old story. When you get caught in a lie when you're a journalist, we stand behind our story. Well, what does that mean? We're using the capital that we've built over time to show you that despite the fact that the story is collapsing, that we think it's true. Instead of coming out and saying, yeah, we made a big mistake, you'll often hear, we stand behind our story, or we stand behind our reporter. And what that means is, yeah, we got caught with our pants down, but we are counting on your goodwill towards journalists to bail us out on this one. And the fact is, there is a except in certain circles, there is no goodwill towards reporters. People know, for the most part, sad to say, they will lie and swear they told the truth in order to get a sensational story. Or, let's put it, I want to be more charitable than that, in that there are people who tell lies that look like the truth from their particular worldview perspective. Mm-hmm. That is worldview bias. And you will see I actually saw a journalist write the other day. There was a rally, and this reporter was sitting in the press pool, and a little kid, probably about 10 years old, held up a sign that said fake news and pointed toward the reporter pool. Yeah. And this journalist, quote unquote, was aghast and said, there is someone who's been brainwashed who doesn't understand that a free and fair press is necessary to the operation of a democracy. Okay, yep. Well, what this person didn't understand was, A, we live in a republic, which is a nation of laws, not a nation of people. We live in a nation of laws. And second of all, she was neither free nor fair. A free press is a press in which journalists are free to express, to report, what they have seen, and do so. You're supposed to report facts. I can remember taking a journalism class, and what did I learn? Who, what, when, where, why, and how? Those are the questions you're supposed to ask. Journalists aren't asking those anymore. Now, regarding being free, yeah, let's talk to John Stossel and Susan Atkinson, who used to work at ABC and CBS, respectively, how well that free press works. It doesn't. When you are in a different position from your editors, your peers, your managers, and that kind of thing, how long does your job last in journalism? It doesn't last at all. You end up out on your own or being hired by someone else. And the fact is that a lot of what passes for journalism is, in fact, opinion reporting. And I have no problems with that. A lot of people will say, well, so-and-so reports the news, and they're really reporting their opinion. And I said, if you look at what they're saying, they're not claiming to be unbiased journalists. They're claiming to come from a viewpoint, which is true. They are. They're saying, I'm from this particular viewpoint. The fact is that most people claiming to be unbiased journalists are coming from a particular viewpoint. But they will tell you that what they are doing is free and fair journalism. Now, fair journalism? There is nothing fair about modern journalism. And never has been. That's the bottom line. It is impossible for human beings to ignore their own prejudices and preconceived notions. When you and I come on here, Barry, do we make the claim that we're completely unbiased?
Let me think. Did you say you were? No, we don't.
No, we are coming from a specific viewpoint. Does that mean we ignore other viewpoints? That is not what we mean. But we are critical of other viewpoints. And if you'll notice, occasionally we're critical of our own viewpoint.
Yeah, this is true. We have to be. I mean, sometimes, you know, we have to like work through some things as we're thinking through them.
Exactly. Exactly. I have many different opinions than I had when I was 20, 30, 40, and 50. I think differently. Why? Because hopefully I've become more mature, and hopefully I've become more learned in certain things, and some of my opinions have changed. I will count the influence of my reading and the influence of God and the Holy Spirit in a lot of that. But the fact is that sitting there and putting yourself up on a pedestal and saying, I'm free and fair, I'm a free and fair journalist, you're lying.
I'm free to do what I want.
Yes.
Any old time.
And the fact is you're not free and you're not fair. So let's just drop that.
They are. They're free to do whatever they feel like because journalistic ethics and integrity have left the room.
It's a non-starter. Yeah. And
if you don't mind, I would like to segue while we still have a little time left, because there is an issue we do need to talk about. We're going to talk about briefly today, and then next program we're going to go into an exhaustive analysis. As pretty much everybody on the planet knows, Monday of this week, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a ruling. And that ruling, I think, kind of fits in with what you just said about, you know, are you free to do whatever you feel like? And the answer is, it depends on who you are. And the ruling that the Supreme Court issued was in a case called the Masterpiece Cake Shop versus the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. That's the cake baker, gay wedding, Supreme Court case. The one that everybody's been waiting on to hear that, you know, I went in December when they were having oral arguments on that particular case and went to D.C. for it. Finally, on Monday, the ruling came out, and the ruling, as reported by that mainstream media and even by some of the conservative media, i.e. Fox News and others, is that it was a very narrow ruling, Chuck. Very, very, very tightly tailored so that really it wasn't a win for anybody, and it was a 7-2 vote. Now, how many times have you ever heard a 7-2 decision being talked about as being narrow?
Never.
Never. Well, and the point is that it really isn't that narrow. It's only if you want to look at it in one sense. And that sense would be from the dissent point of view. The 7-2 vote on this, the seven who voted to find for Jack Phillips, who is the cake baker who owns Masterpiece Cake Shop, in his defense of his actions of refusing to provide a custom cake for two men who were seeking a quote-unquote wedding cake for their gay wedding. Now, interesting thing, Chuck, this thing happened in 2012 before Colorado legalized homosexual marriage. They were going to go to Massachusetts and get married and come back and have a celebration. So, in Colorado at the time, gay marriage wasn't legal. It wasn't recognized. And Jack Phillips is a devout evangelical Christian who decided, rightly so, that his religious belief and his conscience would not allow him to participate and put his time, effort, and creative talent to work creating a cake for a ceremony which he found against his understanding of Scripture. Fair enough, right? Not so much to Colorado, because their Civil Rights Commission has a public accommodations law that included sexual orientation. And so therefore, they treated it that he was, on the basis of the fact that they were gay, he wasn't going to give them a cake. And the case went through the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. It was taken to them. They took it to an administrative law judge who found for the homosexual couple. The Civil Rights Commission then penalized Phillips with fines and, you know, this list of things he had to do with, like, you know, education, retraining, monitoring, you know, reporting to them every 3 months for the next 2 to 3 years. All this other thing to show that he was getting with the program, you know, that he'd been totally re-educated as to the reasons why his views were bad. And that really became a crux of the whole issue, is the Colorado Civil Rights Commission compared his religious belief to the Holocaust and slavery as beliefs, and basically said that it was rhetoric that was used to push a harmful agenda. That's right. Evangelical Christianity is rhetoric to push a harmful agenda against somebody else. Now, do you see the reason why Alliance Defending Freedom and so many other Christian civil liberties groups jumped in on this case?
Oh, absolutely. This is a textbook case of essentially attempting to enforce groupthink, first of all. This is Orwellian, Barry.
Yeah.
He had to go to a re-education center.
Basically, they'd be re-educated to post stuff in his bakery, to train all of his employees, and then to report on any time he turned down a job, he had to report to the Civil Rights Commission all the jobs he turned down and why.
Yeah,
he's a custom cake maker. who is very good at what he does.
Apparently, he's
an expert cake baker, and he's got, like, you know, certifications from God knows how many places. You know, this is his livelihood. This is his vocation. This is what he loves, and he does it to the glory of God. But yet, let's say he had 15 orders, and somebody comes in, and they're like, well, we want a wedding cake for next week. Well, I'm sorry, I can't. I don't have time. Well, it's because we're gay, isn't it? That's why you're turning us down. See, you start that, it ends up creating a Pandora's box of people coming in order to try to mess with them. So the court, in a 7-2 ruling, written by, of all people, Anthony Kennedy.
Okay.
The same Anthony Kennedy who was the swing vote in legalizing homosexual marriage in the Obergefell decision, has decided that maybe he really should rethink this whole thing. And the fact that you have a government entity like the Colorado Civil Rights Commission basically telling someone that your belief system is up to us to decide whether it's valid or not doesn't work. And so basically the holding was that the commission's actions in the case violated the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. In other words, he's got a First Amendment right to exercise his faith, even in his business. That's huge.
That's a gigantic ruling.
That's monstrously big.
That is huge, yeah.
And, you know, and it gets right down here that basically and this is Kennedy writing, and he said basically that the commission's treatment of Phillips' case showed elements of a clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious beliefs motivating his objection. In other words, they basically said, our rule about public accommodation trumps your ability to believe the way you want to, and you have to get reeducated and think the way we do. And the court said, oh, no, you can't do that. You do not have the authority. And again, and here's the big quote, okay? Let's see here. There's what I call the money cord in anything.
Yep.
And let's see here. Yeah. Here's the money cord, one of the money cords in Kennedy's opinion. Says, whatever the confluence of speech and free exercise principles might be in some cases, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's consideration of this case was inconsistent with the state's obligation of religious neutrality. In other words, he's saying, oh, no, government must always stay neutral toward expressions of religion because you are not allowed to take sides. You're not allowed to say that one expression is valid and one is invalid, or one is permissible and celebrated, and the other one is marginalized, vilified, and then made illegal.
That is huge.
Which is where we're heading to with all of this forced compliance to the sexual zeitgeist in our culture.
Okay. Spread that out into, for instance, parents who are having their children forced into what amounts to sensitivity training in local schools in violation of their religious training. In other words,
bingo.
Yeah,
that's the reason why this is not a narrow ruling.
Exactly,
because the Colorado Civil Rights Commission is an appointed board of the state. It's a governmental entity. If they reach down to this commission and not just the state of Colorado or at some amorphous federal level, they're basically saying no level of government can create an environment or rule in such a way where they're showing either favoritism or hostility to an expression of religion. Basically, Kennedy's he's rediscovering the original intent of the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Folks, this is a watershed case. That's the reason why most of the mainstream media and the leftist, folks like CNN and everybody else, nobody's covering this.
Right.
Everybody's trying to play this down. Oh, it was an extremely narrow ruling, and it really probably won't have any effect whatsoever on anything. That's what they're hoping the public buys.
Well, it doesn't matter if the public buys it or not.
Out from us. This is major.
It doesn't matter if the public buys it or not. Because what matters is, do the attorneys buy it? And the fact is that the Alliance Defending Freedom and all the groups who were involved in putting in amicus briefs and those kinds of things know exactly what this says and what the implications are. That means they're going to start filing suits and using this as the stepping stone and more like the fulcrum for the lever on religious freedom cases in all aspects of life.
Okay, and here's the other. I mean, if you really want to hear like the penultimate note coming out of this decision of Kennedy's, here it is. It's on page. If you pull this and you look at the syllabus, it's on page 17 of Anthony Kennedy's majority opinion that he wrote and was joined with by Neil Gorsuch and Alito and Roberts and Breyer and Kagan.
Yeah, I was going to say either has to be Kagan or Sotomayor.
No, Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg both dissented vehemently against this, with Ginsburg writing the dissenting opinion that's about 8 or 9 pages long and being joined by Sotomayor, who are basically arguing a cake is a cake. It's just made out of eggs and flour,
right,
and therefore you've got to bake it, and your religious beliefs can't get involved in this. Because then you're penalizing people unfairly.
It's an attempt to go to the Freudian thing. You know, the Freudian saying that sometimes a cigar is a cigar. No.
Cigar is just a cigar, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's
and
not true in this case.
Neil Gorsuch has a concurring opinion in here that honestly should go in textbooks. Because he takes that dissent apart. And he basically says, wait a minute. You're basically saying that if we rule that it is a particular creation of his, you know, expression, and that he can't be forced to express himself or use his creativity for something he abhors, that's too specific. But if we say that all cakes are alike and it doesn't matter at all, that's too general. So, yeah, we have to say it's a wedding cake, but then it's a wedding cake without any kind of symbolic message or meaning. I mean, he nails it. But here's the money quote from Kennedy's opinion. And he says, because he stated it before, but he states it so much more eloquently here. He says, it hardly requires restating that government has no role in deciding or even suggesting whether the religious grounds for Phillips' conscience-based objection is legitimate or illegitimate. Again, they don't have any role in deciding or even suggesting that someone's deeply held religious belief and conscience convictions are legitimate or illegitimate. They have to take them on the face because that's what the First Amendment is all about. Chuck, this has huge implications.
It has.
Not just in schools. You know, I work for a coalition of medical providers who are trying to say that being forced to take a flu shot vaccine against medical contraindication or against their deeply held religious and conscience beliefs against such vaccinations violates their religious freedom. Here it is. I mean, this can be huge. Now, it's focused on government. So private entity, but if a private entity is doing it because a government, through their policies, has created an environment where someone has to determine someone else's deeply held religious beliefs and force them to comply with an edict that violates those beliefs? Oh, believe you me, we're going to see much more.
Oh, yes, we are. You're right. When you said watershed, it's a watershed. Because what it is it's going back to restoration of the original intent of the First Amendment.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's a beautiful thing. And unfortunately, we are out of time.
Right, and so that's the reason why we're going to pick up and go into more detail in the next program about this particular. And hopefully, between now and then, Chuck, we might actually see some of these supposed you know, not fake news websites actually start looking at this honestly and saying, okay, yeah, this is a bigger deal than we were letting on.
Yeah. Well, that
I'm not holding my
breath. Don't hold your breath. Yeah, that's right. That's always a wise choice when it comes to the free and fair press, and I do have those in quotes. Well, that being said, we are out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.